Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll explore the life of the 11th President of the United States, James Knox Polk, a man who many historians say has been overlooked, unjustly overlooked. He only served one term, but during those 4 years, America changed a great deal, and Mr. Polk had a lot to do with that. We'll be talking this morning with the author of a newly published biography entitled Polk, the Man Who Transformed the Presidency and America. And our guest is Walter Bornman. He is the author of several books, including one that we discussed on this program, 1812, The War That Forged a Nation. Also, his other books include The French and Indian War, Deciding the Fate of North America and Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land. And if you'd like to hear our conversation about the War of 1812, you can go to our web, Focus 580 web archives, and listen to the program. And this morning, as we talk about James Polk, certainly questions are welcome from listeners. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief in their questions or comments so that we can keep moving along and get in as many callers as possible. But people are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-4455 is the number. The toll-free line, if it would be a long-distance call for you, is 800-222-9455. And at any point, you are certainly welcome to call. Mr. Bornman, hello.
Hello, David. Good to be with you again.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I'm sure that we will talk about a number of things here in detail about Mr. Polk and his achievements as president, but maybe one way of asking the question to begin is to talk a little bit about the ways in which America was a different place when he left office. This would have been in the spring of 1849, different from what it was like in when he took office, then that would have been in the spring of 1845.
I think the biggest way that America changed is that suddenly in the 4 years of Polk's administration, it's become a continental country. You know, at the end of talking about the 1812 book, we talked about how that war and everything had sort of fleshed out the country east of the Mississippi. Well, my goodness, during the 4 years of Polk's presidency, we really go all the way across to the Pacific. And Polk basically doubles the size of the country, acquiring the Oregon country from Great Britain, the present-day states of California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and he really solidifies the statehood of Texas. So all of that country west of the Mississippi is really made part and parcel of the United States during his 4 years in the presidency. Mm.
And you can certainly see that there's a map in the book that makes that very plain and very dramatic when you see that that's at that point then America becomes the place, at least geographically, that we know it now. And this was even a more dramatic expansion of territory than I think it's right to say it's even more dramatic than what happened with the Louisiana Purchase.
That's definitely true. And, you know, I think Polk's got a great quote in his final address in 1848 to Congress when he basically says that the Mississippi, which until very recently was our western frontier, now has become the center of the country. And that happened all over in the 4 years of his presidency.
Mm-hmm. There are probably two relationships in his life. I'm sure that he had many important relationships because he was involved in politics for a long time, and he was in Congress, he was Speaker of the House, he was Governor of Tennessee, and he was President of the United States. But perhaps two relationships stand out. One is the relationship he had with his wife, and I'm sure that we'll be talking about that. But in terms of politics, probably the most important person in his life, all through his life, I expect, was Andrew Jackson.
I think that's absolutely true, and I say, and one of the main themes of my book is that Jackson, as Polk's political mentor, really made him president. They have a lot of similarities. They were both born in the Carolinas. They both moved to Tennessee. Rather surprisingly, they were both elected to Congress at the same age of 29. But Polk really followed in Jackson's footsteps. And Jackson was someone who always supported Polk's political career. You know, and I know we'll talk about the dark horse theme a little bit later, too, but when you think about the fact that during Jackson's presidency, Polk is actually in Congress, and for 4 years, he's Speaker of the House of Representatives. So So he's not an unknown. He's somebody who is known on the national stage. And as I write in the book, one of the chapters I call Carrying the Water, and Polk is really carrying the legislative water and programs in Congress for Andrew Jackson.
Yeah. Well, it's something that you point out in the book is that at this time in America, no one was supposed to want to be president. The idea that you would set out to be president and campaign to be president just was not on. Having said that, though, here, as you mentioned, Polk was someone who, by the time he ended up being president, had been in politics for a long time. Obviously, was very skilled in politics. As I said, had been in Congress, as you mentioned, had been the speaker. He was governor of Tennessee. So I suppose one of the things that is often said about him is that he was a reluctant candidate and reluctant president. But I think you would argue that no, that's not true at all.
No, that's indeed the case. I think that Polk wanted to be president. Probably from his early years in Congress. And certainly one of the reasons that he went back to Tennessee to run for governor was to prove that he could carry a statewide race and really, in some respects, to position himself to be a vice presidential candidate in 1840. Now, he didn't get the nomination in 1840, but he certainly was one of the front runners for the Democratic nomination in 1844. And this is someone who, if you read his correspondence, and I relied pretty heavily on his correspondence for this book, there's correspondence between his friends who talk about the plan, almost the plan in quotation marks, where at some point Polk is indeed going to be president of the United States. He's got his friends saying, well, you know, bear in mind you're only 44 or you're pretty young yet. You know, don't push it too hard too quickly. But he certainly has every intention of following in Andrew Jackson's footsteps.
So it's interesting, given that, that he had this ambition that he would say, if elected, when elected, I will only serve one term.
Well, I think that one-term pledge is a very interesting piece of his career. And I think there's probably two reasons why he makes that pledge. He actually makes it as he accepts the nomination in June of 1844 in responding to the nominating committee and saying, almost as you suggested before, David, I haven't sought this office, but, you know, I'm willing to be summoned to it if that's the will of the American people. But what at that point he says that I'm only going to run for one term, and I think he does it for two reasons. First, his opponent, Henry Clay and the Whigs, have as one of their party platforms a one-term pledge. And I think the Whigs have done this because they don't want to see another two terms of Andrew Jackson president for 8 years again. So by going ahead and saying, well, I too pledge that I'm only going to serve one term, he's eliminated that opposition plank from Clay and the Whigs from the political mix. The other thing, and we can talk about, again, this dark horse thing as we move forward a little bit, but out of the convention, the Democratic Convention in Baltimore in 1844, this is a very splintered convention. And even though I contend that Polk isn't a dark horse coming from nowhere to win the nomination, there are other people like Lewis Cass of Michigan, Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, who all want to be president and think that they should be president. Polk needs to unify the Democratic Party. And, you know, it's not dissimilar, David, to maybe 2008. Something needs to be done through this election process at some point to unify your political party. Well, Polk chose to use the one-term pledge to unify his party by saying, okay, all of you who want to be president, unite behind me now, and you won't have to wait 8 years for your chance. You'll only have to wait 4 years.
Our guest is Walter Bornman. He's the author of a new biography of the 11th President of the United States, James Knox Polk. It's titled Polk, the Man Who Transformed the Presidency and America. Random House is the publisher. The book is out now. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Perhaps we could step back a little bit here and talk about Polk's origins and roots. And I think here it's maybe interesting to draw some comparison between Polk and his political mentor, Andrew Jackson, who was the first, and I believe this is true, he was essentially the first American president not to come out of the Eastern aristocracy. And that Polk himself was actually, though, much more like some of his predecessors in the sense that he did come out of the planter class and was a slaveholder. And that perhaps is also one of the reasons that he some people might argue that he doesn't get the isn't ranked as highly as perhaps he should be.
I think that Polk's reputation sort of suffers from, indeed, the Civil War. And the fact that he was, in fact, a slaveholder. And even though I would contend that when it came to whether it was acquiring additional territories or when it would have come, if he had lived and been around at the time of the Civil War, I think that he definitely would have come down on the pro-unionist side, just like Jackson. And I think that Polk's expansionist tendencies were very much in the manner of Andrew Jackson in terms of saying we're going to expand the country not to add additional slave states, but just because, again, that's what we've done. That's what we've done since Jackson went over the Appalachians to Tennessee about 1800. All of this migration that the Jackson family and the Polk family and all of their contemporaries had done from North Carolina to Tennessee sort of takes place again from Tennessee to Texas, and it's a natural progression westward. But as you suggest, by the time we get around to evaluating Polk after the Civil War, and all of these states that he has done so much to bring into the Union in Oregon or California or the Southwest are now being developed, nobody wants to really talk about James K. Polk anymore. They're pro-Union Civil War generals who are out there building railroads and all of those sort of things. So Polk sort of gets lost for, in part, the reasons you suggest of being a slaveholder.
Mm-hmm. He came from this very wealthy background. He was obviously an intelligent man. He could have gone into some different directions. I suppose he could have continued to do that. He studied law. A number of different career paths could have been open to him. Why do you think, though, he was interested in getting involved in politics?
He certainly could have worked in his father's businesses. He could have practiced law. There's an anecdotal story about how he went to law clerk for Felix Grundy, one of Nashville's prominent lawyers, and there were two law clerks in the office, and Grundy said to them, you know, well, one of you ought to come with me to Murfreesboro, where the territorial legislature met at that point, and, you know, I think you could probably be elected clerk of the Senate, and it would be a great experience for you. You'd learn the political ropes, this, that, and the other thing. Well, the other law clerk said, oh, no, I couldn't possibly do that. I have too much legal work to do, and as I say in the book, this other fellow made Polk look like a legal slacker, but Polk jumped at the chance. I mean, he saw law as not an end in itself, but the route to politics, and I think very early on, that's what he decided he wanted to do.
How did, now, I know that the association with Jackson goes back, certainly before Jackson was president of the United States, goes back to Tennessee. How was it that he met and came into Jackson's, Andrew Jackson's circle?
It's unclear exactly when Polk met Jackson, but Sam Polk, James's father, was certainly of that Tennessee aristocracy that intermingled with Jackson a lot. And Jackson certainly stayed at the Polk home in Columbia when he was out on his circuit as circuit judge and some of his other political travelings. So the Polk family and the Jackson family were very close. And even though James is 28 years younger than Andrew Jackson, so that's very much a father-son relationship there. And, of course, this is sort of an appropriate place to then bring in the third family that's involved here, which is the Childress family. And it's going to be Sarah Childress at some point that marries James.
Well, this is, I think, also an interesting relationship. And it's another case where at this time we see the importance of strong women behind these strong men. They themselves couldn't run for office. They couldn't even vote. But they were certainly important in their husbands' lives. And this, we talked a little bit about just how important the relationship with Andrew Jackson was. Well, for Polk, also Sarah was extremely important. They never had any children. So it seems that the two of them, the focus of their life was, in large part, was his political career.
That's true. And just, again, an anecdotal story. Supposedly, Polk went to Jackson at one point and said, you know, well, what can I do to advance my political career? And Jackson is supposed to have said, well, get married. And Polk says, well, to who? I mean, you got anybody in mind? And Jackson says, well, of course. And you know who it is, too. You know her well. She's got brains, intelligence, comes from a good family, well-connected. That's how you advance your political career. Well, I don't think that that Polk really needed Jackson's urging to court Sarah Childress, but she was 8 years younger than James Polk. But you're right, they really provided a team that, particularly in Tennessee politics, some of the letters that go back and forth in later years when he's running for governor and traveling around the state, she's in Columbia, but you can really tell that she's at the center of the campaign network and passing on to him political intelligence and saying, well, in letters, well, you better call on so-and-so over in Knoxville, and, you know, we need to spend a little more time in this part of the state. So they really do have an amazing team.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about what kind of person that she was. There's on the front, the cover of the book, there's reproduced a portrait of Polk. And it looks as if at the around the same period, this was in 1846, the same artist painted both Polk and Sarah.
Yeah.
And the they're reproduced in the book. And I really like this picture of Sarah. It's funny. She kind of has this expression on her face that sort of suggests that she knows something you don't. You just wonder what is going on there.
That's a Healy painting that the originals are in the Polk home in Columbia, Tennessee. But I think that that's a wonderful painting of Sarah. And you're right. I think it's something, sort of a look on her face that says, don't underestimate me.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Walter Bornemann. Again, we're talking about James Knox Polk. He was the 11th president of the United States. Our guest is the author of a new biography of Polk. It's published by Random House. It's out in the bookstore. You can go look for it. And if you have questions, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. It sounds as if in a lot of ways he was a more modern kind of president, perhaps, than those that went before, or at least the way that he worked as an executive is perhaps a little bit more like presidents do today. Am I correct in that?
I think today we might call him a micromanager, but I think you're correct in terms of how he transformed the office of the presidency, is that he required his cabinet to meet twice weekly, on Tuesdays and on Saturdays. It was basically a six-day work week. And where prior presidents, I think, had certainly done some delegation or said to a cabinet secretary, well, you know, do this or do that, Polk really sets up a chain of command where if he wants something done, he's going to see that cabinet secretary reports back. And great insight to Polk's presidency and some of this is a diary that he kept for most of his years in the White House. He doesn't begin it right away, but he begins it in August of 1845 when things over the Oregon crisis sort of begin to come to a head. But through that, there's very clear evidence about how directly he was involved hands-on in terms of the operations of the government. Just one quick example. You know, prior to this, Congress really had pretty much control over the appropriations and the budget. Well, Polk establishes, through his Secretary of the Treasury, what basically today we call the Executive Budget Office. So he's really got a lot of input in terms of how government funds are being used and spent.
We talked a little bit earlier. You talked a little earlier about how when I asked the question, in what way did America change over the 4 years where he was president? Probably the biggest way was that it doubled in size. And they probably, if people think about Polk and think about him in a controversial way, probably the thing that they will think about is the Mexican War and how that happened and what the result was. And that was the way that most of this territory came into the United States. And I suppose some people would say that it was stolen. Let's talk about the Mexican War and how it is that it came about and the way that he conducted this war, in a sense, also dragged the Congress into a war that perhaps it didn't want.
There was a long simmering debate over Texas. You'll recall that basically the Alamo occurs in 1836, and the Republic of Texas is established right after that, and Sam Houston, who again is a Tennessee boy who's got close ties to Andrew Jackson and in fact knows Polk very well, becomes the first president of the Republic of Texas. Well, back and forth through Jackson's administration and also Van Buren's administration, there are various plans to bring Texas into the Union, but they never really come to fruition because the presidents are concerned that it's going to mean war with Mexico, because Mexico really never gives up its claims to Texas. Well, there's a difference of opinion as to, even though Mexico says, well, all of Texas is ours, there's a difference of opinion as to where the boundary is, whether it's the Nueces River, which is a little bit north of the Rio Grande, or whether it's the Rio Grande itself. And the long and the short of it is that once Polk is elected, he says to the Army, go and position yourself along the Rio Grande, which is well into the territory that Mexico claims. And positioning troops there is really just, you know that something's going to happen. And, of course, it does. And when there's an encounter between Mexican troops and American cavalry, Polk has basically his smoking gun, if you will, and is able to say to Congress, American blood has been spilled on American soil, and ask for, basically, say to Congress that a state of war exists, and we want you to declare war on Mexico. Mm.
So he deliberately did a provocative act when the government of Mexico responded, as you might expect. Then he said, "Ha! Look, we've been attacked. We have to respond to this."
That's exactly true. And later on, no less a personality than from Illinois, a young Whig congressman named Abraham Lincoln. 2 years later, when this is still sort of being reevaluated, well, how do we get into this war? It hasn't quite been resolved yet. It's dragging on a little bit. Basically, Abraham Lincoln introduces in Congress his famous spot resolutions, which say, okay, Polk said in his message to Congress, American blood had been spilled on American soil, but you show me the spot where that occurred and prove to me beyond a shadow of a doubt, Lincoln's saying this now, that that was, in fact, American soil. Well, somewhat significantly, and of course Polk had a number of critics from in the Whig Congress by then, but somewhat significantly, Polk never responded directly to Lincoln's charges.
Mm-hmm. And so you, I think you make the argument that this is the point where we really start to see the power to declare war to shift, in a sense, from the Congress to the executive, and if not, in a sense, declaring war, but the executive taking the initiative and then Congress having to trail along behind.
I think that's true. In the War of 1812, of course, James Madison almost wrung his hands before going to Congress and saying, well, we have all these list of grievances against Great Britain. We're feeling pressured on a number of fronts. Congress, look at this information and decide what you want to do. And in 1812, Congress takes at least weeks, some people still think it's too rushed, but takes a period of time to really debate this. By the time that Polk comes around in 1846, and says to Congress that, look, again, American blood has been spilled on American soil, he actually gives them almost a fait accompli, that it's not whether you should evaluate this information. It's a state of war exists. And if you don't rally, American honor has been soiled. And if you don't rally to the cause, then you're basically going to be branded as a coward. And there's a number of people in the Congress, Thomas Hart Benton among them, who think, again, this whole rush to war in 1846 is far too quick, that the executive has seized far too much of the initiative, and that Congress should debate it more. But just like political pressure in subsequent wars, certain congressmen do not want to be branded as either cowards or not supporting American troops or not providing the right appropriations for our armed forces, and they're basically kind of drug along with the flow of events. Hmm.
The other major expansion here was with part of, or maybe it was even most of, what it was known as the Oregon Territory, which included what is now today Oregon, the states of Oregon, Wisconsin, and Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and also B.C., British Columbia. How was it that it came to be before this that this area was, in a sense, jointly held or jointly administered by the United States and Great Britain?
Well, Great Britain and the U.S. had competing claims to all of this territory. And it's territory that basically runs between the 42nd parallel, the northern boundary of California today, all the way up to the southern boundary of Alaska, which, when I tell you that latitude, you'll know one of the slogans from that era, 5440, is that parallel of latitude, which is the southern boundary of Alaska. And, of course, as this debate heated up, there were a number of people in Congress crying 5440 or fight, which basically meant that they wanted to take all of the Oregon Territory all the way up to the southern boundary of Alaska, which would basically encompass British Columbia today. Well, because of these competing claims, there had been a number of treaties where Great Britain and the United States agreed to a joint occupation. Now, you know, that didn't work well in the long term, but there were only a few people in that territory at the time. But as more Americans, beginning about 1843, 1844, began to emigrate to that country along the Oregon Trail, and we start to have these massive wagon trains moving west, Great Britain says, I think we're going to be outnumbered here at some point, and we probably need to resolve this. The United States also wants to resolve it and basically claim as much territory as it can. So there are a number of discussions, and of course at one point it looks like Polk might have to fight a war with Great Britain over Oregon, and if that was the case, he'd be fighting a war on two fronts, one with Mexico over Texas and the other with Great Britain over Oregon. But he manages to resolve the Oregon controversy without war.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that, in fact, that was really what he wanted. He didn't want to fight a war with Britain over this, did he?
No, he didn't. I think he was pretty politically shrewd because he had a number of people in Congress, particularly expansionists in the Northwest, the old Northwest territories that would have included Illinois, Indiana, Michigan. Representatives and senators from those states really wanted all of Oregon, all the way up to 5440. But I think Polk understood that that was going to be pretty difficult to do with Great Britain. Now, on the other hand, there were folks who wanted to settle just at the Columbia River, which would have left the area of that we know today as Seattle and the whole Puget Sound in Great Britain's hands. So what Polk basically did is be in a situation where he said in his addresses to Congress that he was for all of Oregon. But if Great Britain were to make an offer for a reasonable part of it and give part of it to the United States while retaining part, he would at least refer the matter to Congress. He wouldn't act unilaterally as the president. So what that allowed him to do is, when the question came up in Congress that Great Britain was basically proposing the 49th parallel, the current boundary today, Congress, the majority, accepted that. The people who wanted 5440 weren't happy, But Congress basically became the entity that had given up all of Oregon, and Polk became the president who had won Oregon south of the 49th parallel. So it was sort of a win-win situation for him politically.
We are a bit past our midpoint here, and let me again introduce our guest, Walter Bornemann. He's the author of a new biography of James Knox Polk. The subtitle is The Man Who Transformed the Presidency and America. It's published by Random House. It's out now in the bookstores if you'd like to look at it. He's the author of several books, including 1812, The War That Forged a Nation, and we talked about that book when it came out, and if you'd like to hear that conversation, it's on our web archive. Also, he's written about the French and Indian War, and also written the book Alaska, Saga of a Bold Land. Questions are certainly welcome. People want to call in, join in the conversation. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk about things on the fiscal side. One of the things that he did had to do with import tariffs, which turned out to be, well, depending on, I guess, on who you are, either some people thought that was good, the tariffs be reduced, or some people didn't.
I think Polk is what today we call a free trader. He basically wanted imports, taxes, and duties as low as possible. You have to remember that the tariff was fairly important in 1844 because it was primarily the way that we funded the government. There were no income taxes, of course, so tariff revenues was what let the government operate. So you had to at least have enough of a tariff that you were on what they basically called a revenue-producing basis so that you could fund the operations of the government. But if you got over that amount, then there were people like Henry Clay and the Whigs who said, well, sure, we'll take those additional tax revenues and we'll use them, for example, for public improvements and things like that. It's kind of ironic that James K. Polk's Democratic Party in 1844 was very much against those kind of public improvements. There's a harbors and rivers bill that actually comes out of the Great Lakes that Polk vetoes. And he just says there's no way that the federal government ought to be providing funds for every little, what today we call pork barrel, projects throughout the country. And Henry Clay and the Whigs are more interested in doing things like that. Polk very definitely is not. And what the irony that I allude to, of course, is that Polk and the Democratic Party, who are against those kind of social programs and internal improvements, evolves into the Democratic Party of FDR and the New Deal, and, of course, all of the programs and expenditures that Polk could not have ever envisioned.
Hmm. And what about the Treasury, the independent Treasury system?
It's hard for us to believe today when we can go down to branch banks and put things, put a credit card in and withdraw cash, how different it was and how much of an issue the national bank was. In fact, would there be a national bank in the 1820s and 1830s? This is a huge issue that Jackson in particular spends an awful lot of political capital on. But what happens by the time that Polk comes along, he says, look, if the government and the Constitution can put enough faith in the people that they can govern themselves, surely we don't have to look to private banks and private operations to hold that government's money. The government ought to be able to run its own banking operations and hold its own funds. Well, that's what he means when he says an independent treasury. And basically, the treasury system that he sets up, where government funds are kept in government vaults and government banks, that system really stays in place until 1913, when the present Federal Reserve System is put in place.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that perhaps people will not think well of him because of the Civil War and because he came out of this planter class and because he was a slaveholder. What did he think about slavery, particularly the important question about where there should be slavery and where there should not?
Well, there's no question that Polk was a slaveholder. In fact, even though he went to some lengths to keep it very quiet, there's fair evidence that he still continued to buy and sell slaves when he was in the White House. But I don't think, some historians over the years have painted Polk as someone who wanted all this territory west of the Mississippi and this whole expansionist program to foster additional slave states and foster the spread of slavery. Polk's on the record, both in his diary and in his correspondence, as saying a number of times, you know, I just don't understand why we're having this debate over slavery at a national level. It's something that is akin to the South and part of our economic system, but, you know, it's a local matter for us. It's not something that we should be debating on. It's not something that should be part of national politics. Well, of course, in that, he may well have been in step with the planter class of his time. You know, certainly he wasn't in step with abolitionists in the North, and today we abhor the whole system. But that's how Polk felt, and I think part of that mentality of how he almost tried to separate that is again why, after the Civil War, no one was going back and looking at his accomplishments as readily as I've tried to do in this book.
Yeah. It's remarkable. I think that we're now used to the idea that as you see someone move through the term of the president, they're going to age. And particularly if you at any recent president, I'm sure if you look at pictures of them when they took office and when they left, you can see in their face just how much stress there is involved in being president of the United States. And certainly you can see that with Polk. He was, as we've discussed, he was only president one term, 4 years. But it really seems very striking just if you look at, again, here's a there's a photograph of Polk and his wife just near the end of his term. And you can definitely see that the being president must certainly have taken a physical toll on this man.
Polk was always someone who was never physically robust and particularly well. I think that maybe that's one of the reasons that he drove himself so much to try to measure up to the level of people like Andrew Jackson and Sam Houston, folks who really sort of embodied the idea of robust Tennessee frontiersmen. Polk was always afflicted by intestinal issues. In the end, of course, he dies of cholera within 3 months of leaving office. And whether or not that would have happened if he'd stayed in the presidency, or whether or not he could have even survived another 4 years, who knows? But certainly by the time his term is winding down, he confides to his diary on what's his 52nd birthday in November of, let me get the dates right, 1847, that, you know, he's looking ahead toward retirement already. He's only two-thirds of the way through his term, and he's already looking ahead to retirement. So you think of some other presidents over the years, and Theodore Roosevelt, by the way, is one who gives a one. It's not really a one-term pledge because he's served part of William McKinley's term, but he basically says he's not going to run again. And you look at Polk and say, well, gosh, did he really think that he might want to run again? He was under some pressure from the Democratic Party to carry forward, and again, in the face of these two Whig generals, Zachary Taylor and Winfield Scott, who come as heroes out of the Mexican-American War, Polk was under pressure to run again. But he said absolutely no. I don't think that he even flirted with the idea of running again in 1848.
Hmm. So he only lived about 3 months after leaving office, and he died. He was only 53.
That's correct. That's correct. He was a very young man. Sarah goes on to live, oh, I forget the exact age, but the point is that she becomes what's still today the longest surviving presidential widow, and she lives almost 50 years after James has passed on, and as I write in the book, I think really sort of sets the standard for presidential widows keeping the memory of their husbands alive. Now, certainly it was tough for her because, as we've discussed, his reputation, there weren't adoring biographies being written. It was the whole idea of post-Civil War times and the slavery issue and everything. But she goes to great lengths with the Polk Place, where they had hoped to retire, in Nashville, still living there. His tomb is on the grounds, and making that as sort of a sanctuary to his memory.
Mm-hmm. Well, as we've discussed, she was very important to him in his life, very important to him in his career. They did not have children. It seems that she, for all of those years after he died, that she spent, did she spend all of that time in mourning, or almost all of that time in mourning?
I think she really did. She continued to wear black, and of course she was 8 years younger. She was a little bit younger, but she really spent that time in mourning. And you know, George Bancroft, who a historian who had written History of the United States and had served in Polk's cabinet as Secretary of the Navy, and then went on to become ambassador to Great Britain, I think got close to actually doing a Polk biography in the 1880s, which would have been pretty significant, I think, because he had access to Sarah, he had access to all of Polk's papers, he was intimately involved with the Polk administration, but it never came to pass. I think in part because Bancroft himself was well in up in years at that point. But Polk's whole reputation and how quickly he either slips away from public view, which is really the case until the early 1900s, I think his reputation would have been much different if Bancroft had been able to write that biography.
Yeah. Well, you talked about Sarah being, in a sense, the model for the political widow, the presidential
yes.
widow. What did that role involve? What did she do for those decades after he was dead?
I think in the beginning, just receiving people at Polk Place, and basically whether it was school groups from Nashville, whether it was visiting political people, folks like James Buchanan, who actually, of course, had wanted to be president way back in 1844 and continues to want to be president. He would make a political journey to Nashville. There were people in the Democratic Party who would come and ask for her blessing. And again, I think the requisite part of the visit would be to go out on the lawn there, and there's James's tomb, and talk about all of the things that he had done in terms of from doubling the size of the country to lowering the tariff and all of those kind of issues. She really talked about that.
Mm. Our guest is Walter Bornman. We have about 10 minutes left, well, actually more like about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus. He's the author of a newly published biography of James Knox Polk, The Man Who Transformed the Presidency and America. That's the subtitle. It's published by Random House. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You know, I think one of the things, this is in a sense kind of a side issue, but one of the things that's a little, that's kind of interesting about Polk is that he was president in a time when photography was really just starting to be common and a feature of everyday life. And I don't think he was the first American president to be photographed, but he, I think, perhaps was one of the earliest presidents to be photographed a lot. And so that we actually do have images of him. I mean, we also have Andrew Jackson, not after he was president. His photograph is in here, too. But there's also a photograph in the book that is, it's said to be the first photograph ever of a president's cabinet.
That's true. That's correct.
And I think it's interesting that we, not only do we have paintings of him, as we do of his predecessors, but we actually have a lot of photographs of him.
We do. And as you say, it's sort of a transitional period of time, not only in terms of photography, but just as it comes to mind, railroads. You asked at the very beginning how the country was changing. In the very beginning, Andrew Jackson's the first president to ride on railroads. And by the time Polk leaves office and takes this sort of, not really a victory lap, but it's almost that. He takes a long way home to Nashville. He rides on trains a lot, and he and Sarah go to the back of the train, and as I write in the book, basically they don't know it at the time, but they're inaugurating a century of presidential whistle stops. So it's those kind of things that the country is changing so much, whether it's photography or railroads or certainly the whole idea of Western expansionism.
Yeah. Is it, they apparently the idea is that some people at least think that it was making this tour after the presidency, that was when he actually got sick and resulted in his death.
Yeah, I think that that's true. If he'd been able to go directly from Washington to Nashville via the National Road and then just the riverboats down the Ohio and up the Cumberland to Nashville, he might have avoided this outbreak of cholera. He certainly did have a lot of intestinal distress over the years, although it's kind of interesting. I'd suggest to you that part of it was the problem with the water in Washington. Washington at that point is very low level and a lot of swampy areas and things. Polk visits a spa up in Pennsylvania once and drinks some spring water and says how much better he feels. Well, I think part of his intestinal issues were based on a water. But certainly he does become infected with cholera somewhere along this Mississippi steamboat ride and dies shortly thereafter.
Yeah. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation.
Yes.
Let's do that. Line number one, Champaign County. Hello?
I wanted to return to the SPOT Act, which was an act, not a resolution, that Lincoln
yes.
You apparently put forward. How was it that a freshman representative would do that? And was he casting it as a anti-slavery thing even that early? Because, I'm skeptical of that. It was more of an anti-expansionist or a skeptical of expansion. Posture is the way I've heard. What do you think about it?
I don't think he was casting it as an anti-slavery thing. I think that you're correct that he was casting it more as an anti-war issue. And of course, freshman legislators, he could do anything that he wanted. What he does, of course, is that even though he's against Polk taking some of these strong executive actions, his anti-war and anti-expansionist position doesn't particularly wear well in Illinois. And, of course, he chooses not to run again for re-election because he sort of sees the handwriting on the wall that he's not going to be able to win again.
How did it pass? Was it a narrow victory in both houses or what?
No, it didn't actually pass. He just introduced them. I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought it actually had.
No.
So yeah, freshman legislators can do what they want. They can't do much, and they're more disciplined in various times in history, I guess. So I was just wondering whether people can speculate about his motives at the time. And you're suggesting it was authentically anti. Anti-war. There are a lot of things to be said about depths of motivations and multi-factors, I think. But I just did want to put a point on it that, you know, there was some opposition to the expansion and included apparently Lincoln.
Oh, absolutely. And there are a number in the Whig Congress, as they get a majority after the 1846 election, that are very anti Polk's expansionism and his use of executive powers. And, you know, it's pretty ironic, if you think about it, that Lincoln, who is, again, I don't think doing this on slavery issues as much as expansionist issues, and what he sees as Polk being far too strong of a chief executive, it's kind of ironic that less than 20 years later, Lincoln's going to take that to even another level because of the exigencies of the Civil War.
Yeah, well, but he did suspend habeas corpus, but he did bring it to the Congress in a fairly short order, which again was an infringement on the Constitution, but only until it was confirmed, I guess. So, unitary executive theory goes back a long way, apparently.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
All right. We're just about the point we have to finish up. Maybe we have a minute or two left. I guess just as a way of finishing it seems to the case, one of the things you want to say about Polk is that you might want to disagree with what he did and how he did it, but at the very least you would have to see here was someone who came into office with a solid agenda, with a set of things that he was really determined to do, and that over this one term, he actually managed to do all those things.
I think that's really the point, that we might question some of the things that he did in terms of territorial acquisitions based on 2008 standards, but looking at what he did in 1844 and basically saying, look, I've got a specific set of agenda, and I'm going to go out and make sure and do whatever I can to accomplish these, he was able to do that on all of his points, the tariff, the bank, Oregon, and the Southwest.
And how now would you rank him among American presidents?
Well, historically, in all of the Schlesinger surveys of presidential greatness, he comes in 8, 9, and 10. And certainly that's the strongest showing of any one-term president. And I would rank him with the Lincolns or the Theodore Roosevelts. But again, based on that he did what he set out to accomplish, I think he certainly deserves the 8, 9, or 10 ranking.
Well, for those who would like to read more about the life of James Polk, you can look for the book that we've mentioned. It's titled Polk, The Man Who Transformed the Presidency and America, published by Random House, by our guest Walter Bornman. You also might want to look at his book, 1812, The War That Forged a Nation. We talked about that book when it came out here on Focus 580, and if you'd like to hear that conversation, you can go to our web archive and do that. And to you, Mr. Bornman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, David. Good to be with you again.